Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Joe Rogers, registration number 18968, and I represent the appellant in this matter, plaintiff Deborah Sanders. Your Honor, first of all, let me just note, with an apology to the court, to the extent that there was a tone in terms of the books in and of themselves that was otherwise inappropriate. I would agree fully with the court that that would be inappropriate. There was no doubt that this was a heated case. There was a battle, so to speak, between the parties. And this ultimately came down to really a fight about the essence of the case. The essence of this case came down to two surgeons. It was two surgeons that had performed surgery on Deborah Sanders, that viewed her anatomy, and once they saw her anatomy and felt that her anatomy was misconstructed, in and of themselves, those surgeons were the only eyes on view of what occurred here. They were the only eyes on view. There was no camera, there was no videotape. It was simply them and their testimony. And those surgeons were not allowed to testify at trial about exactly what it is that they found in the context of it having been negligent or breach of the standard of care.
Well, let me ask about that, Mr. Rogers, because sure. I mean, it's my understanding is, and I read a large part of the record myself, mm-hmm. they got to testify that this didn't look like, is it Roux-en-Y, is that how you say it?
That's exactly right. Okay.
They got to testify at length about this didn't look like a Roux-en-Y, they didn't put Ms. Sanders together correctly, they got to say, the only thing they didn't get to say was this violated the standard of care in the specialty. But you did have an expert who did testify about the standard of care. Mm-hmm. So two things. One, I'm not sure where's the harm? Where is Ms. Sanders' prejudice here? When you got to put on an expert to say, this violates the standard of care, you got to have these two surgeons, who obviously were credible and experienced, say why this was problematic. You could put two and two together in argument, say you violated the standard of care. So I'm having trouble understanding where you were harmed just because these two guys couldn't testify in violation of standard of care. The judge let him say everything up to those words,
yes.
Seems to me. So where's the harm?
The harm comes into the cumulative impact of it, Your Honor. When you look at the case, it came down to essentially two surgeons who were supposedly specialists in the standard of care on the defendant's side. It was their paid expert who they had testified, Dr. Matthew Metz, and it was Dr. Frank Shea. So they had two experts on that side that said, in effect, there was no breach of the standard of care, everything was fine. What was the plaintiff, in effect, left with in this case? A paid expert who said there was a breach of the standard of care, but then nothing else to counterbalance that. So you had two experts on the other side and one expert on the plaintiff's side. Now you can argue, well, wait a minute. In every case, you may have some imbalance, if you will, of testimony or evidence. What was wrong about this case is it was inconsistent with the standards as set forth by the court in Hall v. Frankel, and frankly as set forth by Melville. It makes clear that you're entitled to have an expert testify in a case if the expert is qualified. It's not just a matter of them not asking that single question, and I would argue, Your Honor, that that's the most important question. The most important question was, keep in mind what they were able to say. It was improper. I wouldn't have constructed her anatomy this way. It was a misconstruction of her anatomy, and they said those things, but they weren't allowed to state, in effect, what it was. Was it negligent? Was it a breach of the standard of care? And, Your Honor, in that context, it's no different than this. You and I watching a football game, and I don't know if you're all football fans or not, but pick your sport. If you're a football fan and you're watching a game, and a referee is allowed to throw a flag, so he throws a flag, indicating that something was wrong. But he never tells the audience, never tells the teams, never tells the fans what the flag was thrown for. So in other words, you have an indication that something was done wrong, but because you're not told specifically what it was, you don't know.
Well, I suppose the problem, I'm sorry, Judge, go ahead.
But let me expand on Judge Gabriel's question a little bit. These were your witnesses.
Yes.
What do you do about the fact that they both said, I'm not prepared to talk about the standard of care on bariatric surgery. I'm not going there. So, what's mm-hmm. the judge supposed to do under those circumstances? They can't force him to testify about something that they themselves say, I'm not an expert in that. I can't do that, and I'm not going to do it.
And they had no intention of doing that, and nor did we intend to offer them for that purpose, Your Honor.
But you wanted to ask them the standard of care question.
But the standard of care was bifurcated, Your Honor. Keep in mind, the standard of care related to the creation of the Roux-en-Y, the common surgical procedure. No different than in Hall v. Frankel, the commonality of the assessment of blood clots, for example. It commonly interprets certain branches of medicine. In the context of this case, it was the creation of the ruin. Why? They weren't interested in commenting about bariatric surgery or weight loss surgery or how the size of the stomach, relatively speaking, that was created. All they were commenting about was the ruin. Why? And it was the ruin. Why, in and of itself, which is common to other branches of medicine. Whether you are a bariatric surgeon, in this case, that is no different than being a general surgeon, because there is no certification, no board certification, no national certification in bariatric surgery whatsoever. You are simply a general surgeon who performs surgery on an exclusive portion of the population.
But they were able to testify to all of it. Everything that you just said, they were able to testify to.
You're exactly right. But, Your Honor, at the end of the day, how was it evaluated? At the end of the day, what did the case come down to? It came down to an instruction. The jury received an instruction in this case that said what? It said you're measured in this case to determine whether a physician's conduct was negligent. You must compare that conduct with what a physician having and using the knowledge and skill of physicians practicing in the same specialty at the time would or would not have done in the circumstances.
And you stipulated to that instruction?
We certainly did. And the reason that that was stipulated to, Your Honor, is one, we had a ruling from the court in the case earlier on stating that he believed that Dr. Shea was a specialist in and of itself. That was going to be ground that it was simply not worth walking over. But what we wanted in the case was what Jordan Greer Wagner gives us, a second instruction as to how you assess the testimony of the general surgeons, the treating surgeons in this case. And in effect, what happened here is their testimony was rendered of no effect. How is it, Your Honor, and I believe it absolutely as you're suggesting it, they were allowed to state everything. That it was misconstruction, that it was improper, all of that, Your Honor, was implicitly standard of care testimony. But yet when the jury received an instruction, they were in essence told to disregard all of it because they were not specialists in the particular as identified by both the court and by identified, according to the defendant, he identified himself as a specialist.
Well, where does that instruction say that the jury's to disregard it all? I mean, they get to consider it, and then your expert in the standard of care gets to say, did you hear what Dr. Murphy and Dr. Gerding said? You know, they said he did everything. This Dr. Shea did everything wrong. That, ladies and gentlemen, my expert opinion violates the standard of care, and I am an expert in bariatric surgery.
Exactly.
That, I assume you made that argument. So how does the jury, you've said a couple of times now, the jury was told to disregard everything Drs. Murphy and Gerding said. I don't see where there's anything like that happen.
Your Honor, by the instructions themselves. If you have an instruction that tells you that you're only supposed to measure the doctor according to another specialist, then do you implicitly disregard the testimony of a, quote, non-specialist? You do. And it's implicit as a result of the instruction. If they had received the counterbalancing instruction, the one that also measured a general surgeon who would testify about the standard of care related to a common surgical procedure, then in that circumstance, you have balance there at least. They can weigh their testimony. But because you were only given the specialist standard of care and you were only given the specialist instruction, in effect, as a practical matter, and I don't mean to suggest that somebody told them to disregard, but in effect, they were disregarding the testimony of Dr. Gerding and Dr. Murphy in this case. That's implicit in terms of what happened.
Well, how's that different in you know, other cases? You got 12 fact witnesses and one expert. Mm-hmm. On your theory, the jury would understand that they're supposed to disregard all the fact witnesses. I mean, the trial judge here at some level treated Drs. Murphy and Gerding as fact witnesses, you know, saying, here's what I saw.
Yes.
And, you know, I don't know that that's so out of line here. Again, you do have it. So your expert relies on the facts and draws a conclusion. This violates the standard of care.
There are a couple of reasons why it was out of line here, Your Honor. Specifically, what happened was this. Keep in mind the cautionary instruction that was given by the judge in the case. He specifically told the doctors that you were not to state anything about what Dr. Shea did or didn't do. You may not comment about that. And so what does defense counsel ask then Dr. Murphy? They say, Dr. Murphy, you're not suggesting that this was a negligently caused result in terms of this operation. You're not suggesting that Dr. Shea did anything wrong, are you? And of course he says no. But why does he say no? He only says no after having been instructed by the court the day before that he is not to provide any testimony in that regard.
But wasn't the court's instruction based on the testimony of the doctors who said, we don't have a clue what Dr. Che did. We haven't looked at his notes. We don't know. We weren't there.
Sure.
There wasn't a video. So we're not going to testify about that anyway because we just simply don't know.
They did know, Your Honor. And what they did know was this. They didn't know what Dr. Che's operative notes were. Those were simply his dictated notes as to what he said the procedure was that he performed. But they knew ultimately what he performed because they had an eyes-on view of the anatomy. They had the best view. When they opened her up and saw her anatomy configured the way it was and saw that it was misconnected the way it was, they had the ultimate view of what Dr. Che had performed in terms of the surgery. And that's what they were willing to comment about.
And they did.
They did. They commented about what they found, but they were not able and not allowed to state that what they found was in fact negligent and a breach of the standard of care. And that is the ultimate question in a medical malpractice case. That's what it all comes down to.
Mr. Rogers, I'm sorry if I missed it in the record, did your expert, Dr. Flanschbaum, did he opine to the anatomy of Ms. Sanders?
He did.
And I assume his opinion was it was negligent and didn't meet the standard of care?
That's exactly right, he did.
Was it based on the findings of the two doctors?
Yes, it was explicitly based on those findings. And so he testifies in that regard, he states that. But what was interesting about it, Judge, forgive me, Judge Grebo, you specifically said, Joe, you could argue that point. You can argue it. I was denied the right to argue that very point. I was denied the right to argue that Dr. Che was negligent in this case or that he breached the standard of care because I was not allowed to use the word standard of care or the phrase standard of care or anything related to standard of care as it related to the testimony of Dr. Murphy and Dr. Gurdy. The trial court specifically barred me under threat of contempt of court that if I did so, it would be in violation of the contempt of court and I could be jailed for doing it. That was wrong to do. It was hamstringing us in the case, no different than a fighter who's literally trying to fight a fight and tied with one hand behind his back. We weren't allowed to make that argument before the jury.
Mr. Rogers, you've got just a couple minutes, and I assume you want to save some time for rebuttal.
Yes,
if I can shift gears briefly, could you, I have to tell you, I'm having a lot of trouble understanding what happened with these exhibits and the chronology of that. Could you take maybe 43 seconds, save some time, whatever, and just clarify for me, I couldn't tell what exhibits the jury had when.
All they had was the defendant's exhibits. When the jury went out, in particular, the judge sent the jury out, they had the plaintiff's exhibit notebook and the defendant's exhibit notebook. They did not have the original trial exhibits.
The court, where they were in the courtroom somewhere?
They were in the courtroom, but the court wanted us to go through identification of the exhibits, making sure that they were appropriately lined up and otherwise. So the jury had the plaintiff's exhibit notebook and the defendant's exhibit notebook. In the midst of their deliberations, roughly a half hour into it, all of a sudden defense counsel raises an objection and says, we don't know where the exhibits are, or we don't know the plaintiff's exhibits. We haven't seen them. It was an entirely improper objection. We fought about it, and obviously in terms of the issue. The court ultimately pulled the plaintiff's exhibits away, left the defendant's exhibits there. The court then goes on ultimately a lunch break. We did not know at that time that the exhibits were not ultimately returned back to the jury at all, including the original trial exhibits. So over half of the jury's deliberations, all they had were the defendant's exhibit notebooks. That was it. Nothing else. And frankly, we do not know. The only time the issue was raised is when we had a question from the jury, and the judge called us in to answer the question. The jury, they said, where is Dr. Murphy's operative notes? And the judge refused to provide them the admitted exhibit. The jury didn't have the operative notes because they didn't have plaintiff's exhibit notebooks, and they also did not have the original trial exhibits.
But they ultimately got them, correct?
We don't know that. We don't know that.
The record is pretty clear that the original exhibits were ultimately given to the jury.
Your Honor, the record indicates that the judge indicates we're going to send them back. The same record indicates that that was said the first time. In other words, I'm so concerned about the time. After the plaintiff defendant raised an issue up about our exhibits in particular in the case, and the judge pulled them out, we made an immediate correction, which they said to remove one of the cover sheet pages. After that was removed, We were told that the exhibits were going back to the jury. They never went back to the jury.
How do you know that?
Because they were sitting on the judge's desk.
Are you telling me that there's evidence in the record that the original exhibits never got to the jury?
No.
I didn't think so.
I don't mean to suggest that, Your Honor. What I'm suggesting is that we had an error with respect to plaintiff's original exhibits being returned back to the jury after we were told that they were going to be returned back, and they were not returned.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Todd Drake, registration number 27258, on behalf of the appellee, Dr. Frank Shea. Your Honors, as you correctly identified, the linchpin of this case turns on this question. Can general surgeons who do not specialize in bariatric surgery, who do not perform bariatric surgery, who testify they are not experts in bariatric surgery, should they be permitted to give standard of care opinions against a bariatric surgeon? That is the entire crux of plaintiff's argument.
I'm sorry to jump in right away on you, Mr.
Sure.
Drake. Was there any evidence that the Roux-en-Y procedure was different when done for bariatric purposes than for other purposes? As I understand Mr. Rogers' argument is, there wasn't. In fact, the evidence was it's the same Roux-en-Y procedure regardless.
Dr. Murphy actually testified the exact opposite, Your Honor. Dr. Murphy testified, and I can give the court the cite, Dr. Murphy testified that there are differences in why Roux-en-Y is done for gastric bypass purposes and why it's done for other purposes. We acknowledge
But is the procedure different? I understand it may be done for different reasons. I remember that testimony. But do you do it differently depending on what reason you're doing it for?
The Roux-en-Y, the technique of a Roux-en-Y is done the same regardless of what procedure it's done for. All a Roux-en-Y is essentially an anastomosis. It's a reconnection of two body structures. And Roux-en-Y refers to, instead of connecting them end to end, you connect them end to side. And so that's done regardless of the surgery. That's done in cardiac surgery. It's done in GI surgery. It's done in arthroscopic surgery. So the Roux-en-Y itself, no, that technique is something that is used across the spectrum. The key, though, and this is the testimony of Dr. Murphy, is that there are differences within those procedures, that the Roux-en-Y for gastric bypass is something that is done differently than a Roux-en-Y. While the technique's the same, that procedure is a different procedure. And it's particularly important, Your Honor, because in this case, both experts, as you identified, Judge Loeb, both of these general surgeons testified they had no familiarity with how it's done in gastric bypass. They both said, I am not an expert in it. I can't testify about how a gastric bypass surgeon, a bariatric surgeon, does this. So there's no evidence in the record that would tell, you know, Mr. Rogers wanted to argue to the jury, but basically make this implication that because a Roux-en-Y, that surgical technique, what they saw, these two general surgeons saw, was something they didn't understand or was not consistent with what they had seen for Roux-en-Ys. He wants to then make that leap to they then can say that what Dr. Shea did in this bariatric surgery was negligent. And they both specifically said, I don't have the foundation to do that. I cannot give opinions about bariatric surgery.
But Mr. Drake, what about Mr. Rogers' point that that testimony came out after the court had already prohibited them from making a standard of care opinion?
Well, Your Honor, I do disagree with Mr. Rogers in that, first of all, that testimony came out through voir dire. Now, when they were asked on voir dire, both experts, both the general surgeons were asked about their familiarity with this. Dr. Murphy, in particular, on voir dire, agreed, I am not giving any standard of care opinions about Dr. Shea. It would not be appropriate for me to do so because I do not practice that specialty. He also agreed during voir dire that the only fair thing for him to do would be to state what he saw in terms of the Roux-en-Y because he lacked the familiarity. Those were his words. He lacked the familiarity with a bariatric surgery to testify about it. They then it then did come out again during the testimony. It was certainly after the court had ruled on whether or not they could provide standard of care opinions. It was then, of course, emphasized by the defense to say, you're not an expert in this area, right? And you're not saying that this was negligence. The point Mr. Rogers made, Dr. Murphy specifically said, I'm not saying this was negligence by Dr. Shea. I don't have the basis for it, and I'm not even suggesting that anything he did resulted in this complication for Ms. Sanders. I'm not saying it was negligence. So I do disagree. I think it came out during voir dire. Regardless, I don't know that that has any effect either way, Judge. The experts can only testify within the bounds of their qualifications. And regardless of when it comes out, it would have been inappropriate if at any time those two general surgeons had testified, Dr. Shea breached the standard of care for a bariatric surgeon. They acknowledge that. They acknowledge it would be inappropriate for them to do that. Harris, this is Mr. Rogers talked about the Melville case. I suggest the Melville case is nearly dispositive on this issue. In that case, you had a podiatrist who performed foot surgery on a patient. Subsequently, an orthopedic surgeon came in and did a reconstructive or a corrective surgery on the foot. The orthopedist then, the plaintiff wanted to use the orthopedist at trial to testify that what the podiatrist did was negligent. The Colorado Supreme Court specifically held that was error. An orthopedist cannot testify about what a podiatrist does, even though they're working on the exact same body part, they're essentially doing the same or similar procedures. Podiatrists are governed by their own specialty standard of care. Orthopedists are governed by their own specialty standard of care. And there's good reasons for this. You know? First of all, a specialist is governed by a national standard of care. It's not a local standard of care. The concept of standard of care as it relates to general physicians arose in the context of where you had general physicians practicing out, you know, in rural areas, isolated areas. And what the courts held was that it was not proper to hold that kind of physician to a standard of care that specialists in other areas, particularly in urban areas, would be held to. So what they held was that a general physician in a situation like that was actually a lower standard of care. So a specialist, and this is what the court recognized in Melville, it's now codified in the Colorado Revised Statutes, is that specialists are entitled to be governed by their heightened standard of care. It's not appropriate for a general surgeon or any kind of general physician to come in and say, I know what this specialist did was wrong because it's not the way I do it. That simply is an improper statement of law. General surgeons are held to a general standard of care. Specialists, like Dr. Shea, it's undisputed that Dr. Shea was a specialist. The court specifically recognized there's just no question about that he was a specialist. As a specialist, he was entitled to be governed by the standard of care for specialists, for bariatric surgeons. Judge Loeb, you raise a key point as well with this. And while the court primarily made its finding on their qualifications to testify, it did also address, it was a specific argument by the defense, that these general surgeons had no evidentiary foundation to give those opinions, even if they had been qualified to give standard of care testimony against a bariatric surgeon. They both acknowledged, we don't know what Dr. Shea did. We've never read his report. We've never seen his notes. We weren't at the surgery. There was no video of the surgery. Dr. Murphy said it best. He said, I have no idea what Dr. Shea did. So this argument that because they had eyes on Ms. Shea, that when they opened her up and they saw something in the anatomy, that they then knew what Dr. Shea did, that's simply incorrect. What they knew was what they saw there. They still to this day don't know what Dr. Shea did. They don't know what his assistant did in the surgery. They don't know. Ms. Shea, and this is in the record, Ms. Sanders, had a number of abdominal surgeries through her medical history. When they opened her up, what they saw was in their mind a mess, but they couldn't attribute it to any specific physician. And that's where Dr. Murphy, it's exactly what he said was, I can't tell you what Dr. Shea did, so I can't tell you whether or not what he did was negligent. I have no idea what he did. And I think that's a key factor as well, Judge Loeb, is not only are they not qualified to give those opinions, they lack the evidentiary foundations to give such opinions. Let me talk briefly, first of all, on the issue of this, on the jury instruction. As you point out, Judge Loeb, it was a stipulated instruction. The specialist instruction is the proper instruction to give in a case like this where it's undisputed that the defendant was a specialist. Mr. Rogers, a plaintiff, agreed with that in this case. What he instead once argued at the trial court was that in addition to a specialist, you have to give a general jury instruction. And I think it's notable to the point that I believe Mr. Rogers is trying to make is that that instruction would tell the jury how they were to assess the testimony of the general surgeons. It was not to the standard of care. And Your Honor, the instruction that's tendered, the 15-2 instruction, is an instruction on standard of care. It tells the jury not how they assess a witness's testimony, it tells them how do they gauge the defendant's conduct. So to give them an instruction under which you would say, you can gauge this defendant's conduct in the way of a general surgeon, would be clear error. And that's, the Jordan case makes that very clear, where there is not a dispute as to that the defendant is practicing a specialty, you should not give multiple instructions. That's exactly what happened. Jordan, the trial court, had given both the specialist and non-specialist instruction, and as a result, there was no way for the Court of Appeals to determine how the jury made its assessment of the defendant's conduct.
Finally, Mr. Drake, before you run out, maybe you're about to get to this, I would appreciate if you would help me with this exhibit issue too, because like I said, with respect to everybody, the record is a mess, and I can't figure out what happened with the exhibit. So would you give me your version of what happened?
I certainly will, Your Honor. I believe the record does support this, and I don't disagree that it's somewhat a mess in the context of a trial, the end of a trial. It's not usually something that this comes up and would be recorded. I think what the record makes clear is that when prior to closings occurring, it was clear that a record would have to be made on the exhibits, not on juror notebooks. And this is really the flawed premise of that argument, is that there were two notebooks. There's a juror notebook that the jurors are given that does contain some exhibits, but it also contains their notes. It contains, it's a whole host of things. It's not the exhibits. It's not the original exhibits that are given. The juror notebooks were what went back with the jury. The exhibits themselves were not given. In fact, the trial court says, when he discharges the jury to go to the jury room, he says, we will bring you the instructions, verdict forms, and exhibits as soon as we can get them all together. That's on the transcript from October 20th at page 35. So they didn't have any exhibits when they went back. They had their juror notebooks. And as Mr. Rogers correctly pointed out, there became an issue. There was concern that within the plaintiff's juror notebook, that maybe some things had been included that the defense counsel had not yet seen. Defense counsel raised that concern. Because of it, the trial judge said, well, I'm going to have to remove that exhibit, or not exhibit, but the juror notebook then, so that we can look at it and make sure it's fine. He pulled that out. During that time, a record is being made on the exhibits. None of the exhibits have gone back. This idea that the jury at some point only had defense exhibits is not supported by the record. The exhibits had not gone back to the jury. None of the exhibits went back to the jury until after lunch.
But at some point, the jury had the defense notebooks, juror notebooks, with whatever exhibit you chose to put in there, but not the plaintiff's notebook. But the original exhibits were not there at some period.
That's exactly right. The original exhibits did not go back until after lunch. Mr. Rogers acknowledged that when it was kind of a unique situation, the court took a lunch, and so for about an hour, the notebooks did sit there because they were still essentially being worked out as to what was going to be. In fact, when the judge came back from lunch, there was still an issue of there was a divider page within those original exhibits that said plaintiff's medical records. Defense objected to that, and the court ordered that be removed. Once that was removed, Mr. Rogers acknowledged that, okay, you're back from lunch now, Judge. These exhibits can now go back to the jury. And so this, again, and more importantly, as Judge Lope correctly pointed out, the record is very clear. All the exhibits were back with the jury for, at a minimum, 3 hours and 15 minutes. They had those exhibits for the majority of their deliberations. There was never any point in time where they did not have Dr. Murphy's post-operative note or anything. This suggestion that because they asked a question, can we get the note, that they didn't have it, is just wrong. Again, it's acknowledged in the record that that was a specific exhibit, was in the exhibit notebook. All the judge was trying to do was not to highlight that. He didn't want to tell them, yes, it's in there and here's where it's at. All he did was refer them back to the exhibits. You have the exhibits that you can consider. That exhibit was in there. They had those exhibits for 3+ hours. They had it during their deliberations, but there simply is no error there, Your Honors. And to the extent that some brief period of time, they only have the trial notebooks from the defendant versus plaintiff, I would argue that is harmless error, Your Honor, that it did not affect the substantial right of plaintiff. At no time was jury not given some exhibit.
Can you help me on the timing, Mr. Drake, of this jury question? When the jury asked the question about the post-op notes, did they have the original exhibits at that point?
It was right at that same time, Your Honor. I think the record supports that question came out. The parties and the judge determined how they were going to respond to that. And at that time, all the exhibits also went back, because that was when the judge said, I also have your exhibit notebooks here, and these are now ready to go back to the jury, right? So at the same time that they were getting the answer, you have all the exhibit notebooks, all the original exhibits were going back at that time.
Thank you.
And I think that does maybe explain why originally they said, can we get his post-operative note? Because it wasn't in the trial notebooks, but it was in the original exhibits, and they got that. Your Honors, we believe the record supports that the judge made correct decisions. The case did not abuse its discretion in any of these rulings. It's unquestioned that these were all under the abuse of discretion standard. We therefore ask that you affirm the trial court's judgment in Dr. Shea's favor.
Thank you, Mr. Drake. Mr. Rogers, by my count, you got just a few seconds, but I know you were trying to respond to Judge Gabriel's question, so I'd ask if the bailiff would give you another extra 30 seconds if you've got anything you want to say in rebuttal.
Please, if I may,
just let him fiddle with the clock first, and then you can start.
Absolutely.
This high-tech stuff befuddles us all.
Sure.
Okay, you got 30 seconds.
Your Honor, if they didn't fix it, then there wasn't a problem. They fixed it. They saw the construction of her anatomy. They performed a second surgery to remove the missed connections as made by Dr. Shea. And once they made those misconnections, once they corrected his misconnections, then she was fine. The whole notion that there was nothing wrong and that this was simply a mystery, why did they perform a second surgery if that would be true? They knew what they found. They knew it was wrong. The jury did not have plaintiff's exhibits during the entire time at all in terms of this case. And the evidence supports that fact, and they did not have the original trial exhibits. It was a working lunch. The judge instructed the jury that they were to deliberate during the lunch and that they would receive lunch brought in by the court. The jury was out the entire time. They did not have plaintiff's exhibits or the original trial exhibits during 2.5 hours of their deliberations. They only had defendant's juror notebooks.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. Division will issue an opinion in due course. That does